From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Bloodbath in the Niger Delta. Nigerian soldiers open fire on youths demanding oil companies leave Nigeria. In Riverside, California, hundreds protest the police shooting death of a 19-year-old woman. The FBI says it will now investigate. And what does Y2K mean for the progressive community? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The FBI is getting involved in the death of a black teenager named Taisha Miller, shot a dozen times by police in Riverside, California. Federal prosecutors say the FBI will do a preliminary investigation into whether 19-year-old Taisha's civil rights were violated. After that, they'll decide if a full investigation is warranted. Yesterday, hundreds of people marched from Riverside City Hall to the police department calling for an independent investigation. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. A body found on the side of a road near Laramie, Wyoming, Sunday turned out to be the mother of a suspect in the beating death of a gay college student. Cindy Thompson Dixon was found just north of town. Her son is behind bars awaiting trial in the October death of Matthew Shepard, who was found tied to a fence in October. Authorities say Dixon's death appears suspicious, and they're treating it as a possible homicide. Early results from an autopsy point to hypothermia as the cause of death. A final ruling won't be made until toxicology tests are completed. Dixon's husband is due in court today on a charge of battery on a member of his household, but no details of the case are available. President Clinton is proceeding with plans to give a State of the Union speech on January 19th, while his lawyers prepare for an impeachment trial to begin as early as next week. But a presidential spokesperson left the door open to rescheduling the annual report to a joint session of Congress in order to accommodate the impeachment proceedings. White House spokesperson Joe Lockhart told reporters the president is hard at work on putting together the State of the Union address, but asked whether it would be a problem for Clinton to give the address at the same time he's undergoing an impeachment trial in the Senate. Lockhart indicated the trial arrangements being developed this week in the Senate could affect planning. United Nations officials in Angola today demanded a ceasefire between government troops and UNITA rebels to allow access to the crash sites of two UN planes shot down in the past 10 days. Our appeal is to all parties. There can be no ceasefire with one side. This said Renan Sevan, UN Undersecretary General for Security, told reporters this after meeting Angola's vice foreign minister. He said those with information should come forward and help the UN and stop making statements that they have never been in touch. He said this referring to UNITA, which has repeatedly denied the UN has contacted them or asked for a ceasefire. 10 days ago, a UN-chartered C-130 Hercules with 10 passengers and 4 crew aboard crashed in flames near Huambo in the country's central highlands, where troops have been engaged in intense fighting with UNITA since December 5th. On Saturday, a second UN-leased C-130 was down soon after takeoff from Huambo en route to the capital, Luanda, to the northwest, with 4 passengers and 4 crew on board. No one knows if anyone survived either crash. UNITA, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, formerly supported by the United States and apartheid South Africa, blames the shooting down of the planes on the government. And one spokesperson has said there were no survivors, but he admitted UNITA had not visited the crash site. The government accuses UNITA of bringing down the planes. And the UN Security Council considers today Iraq's moves to oust American and British relief workers on grounds it could not guarantee their safety because of widespread anger since last month's airstrikes. No immediate action was expected from the 15-nation body, but its members as well as UN officials will probably make their first comments on the news, initially related to the United Nations in Baghdad last Thursday. Iraq so far has moved gingerly and only asked the UN to replace one American American and 13 Britons. This, according to diplomats. And Iraq accused the United States today of violating international law by maintaining no-fly zones in its northern and southern airspace. Yesterday, two priests, two nuns, and a religious laywoman were sentenced in Maryland to between 4 and 10 months for a plowshares action they engaged in last May. You may remember Democracy Now! Was there on May 17th when the five, calling themselves the Gods of Metal Plowshares, hammered and poured blood on a B-52 bomber during the Department of Defense open house at Andrews Air Force Base in Prince George's County, Maryland. The Gods of Metal Plowshares hammered, leafleted, played, prayed through their own blood, and now face between 4 and 10 months in prison.
If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then
you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we just reported, the FBI says it's getting involved in the death of a black teenager shot at least a dozen times by police in Riverside, California. Federal prosecutors say the FBI will do a preliminary investigation into whether 19-year-old Taisha Miller's civil rights were violated. After that, they'll decide if a full investigation is warranted. Police in Riverside, California, say they found Miller asleep in a car with a gun in her lap last week. They say they opened fire when she woke up and grabbed the weapon. But Miller's relatives claim the shooting was racially motivated. They've already filed a lawsuit. Some 300 protesters marched in front of Riverside Police Headquarters yesterday, demanding an independent investigation of the police shooting and a civilian review board. These are the facts as we know them so far. On the morning of December 28th, that's two Mondays ago, at about 2 a.m, Taisha Miller, 19 years old, and her cousin drove into a gas station in Riverside because they were having car trouble. As her cousin went to make a call, she locked herself, Taisha Miller, in the car. It is not clear whether she had a gun to protect herself. When her cousin came back, they saw her in the car, and she seemed to be unconscious, somehow in distress. The cousin then called the police. The police came to the car. They saw Taisha Miller inside, somehow unconscious, perhaps through a seizure or whatever. And after a while, they broke open the window. At that point, the police say that Taisha Miller picked up the gun. At first, they said she shot at them. They have later retracted that statement. And lawyers for Taisha Miller are saying it's also not clear whether she had a gun. Either way, at that point, at least four police officers, three white and one Latino, opened fire, shooting Taisha Miller at least 12 times, several of those times in the head. And this has led to the protests of the last week and a half, culminating in yesterday's protest of at least 300 people in Riverside calling for an independent investigation. Leaders then met with the police chief as well as the mayor of Riverside. There were meetings last night as well. And right now, we're joined by two people who have been involved in those protests. We're joined by Don Bardo, president and CEO of the Urban League of Riverside and San Bernardino Counties, as well as Reverend Burnell Butler, who is a cousin of Taisha Miller and who has been leading the protests as well. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Reverend Burnell Butler. Can you tell us what your understanding is of what happened to your cousin Taisha two Mondays ago?
Well, my understanding, she had a flat tire. She came to the station. She was with a friend of hers. The friend and her tried to fix a flat tire. They couldn't. A passerby, another motorist, a white motorist, stopped and helped them put on the spare. Spare was a space saver. It was deflated. and it rubbed on the side of the car. At that time, he gave the other girl that was with her a ride over to the west side of town, and she made some phone calls, called the relatives. The relatives were coming with a AAA card. When they got there with a AAA card, the one cousin found the doors locked and the heater was on because it was a cold morning, and the stereo was up loud. She thought there was something wrong with Taisha. She was not responding to their knocking on the window and kicking the door, so they went and got the gas station attendant. The gas station attendant said that Taisha had parked under the light and told him that she was out there waiting for relatives and she was fine I guess 15 or so minutes earlier. And then when he went out there, she did look like she was in the medical distress or something, and he recommended to call 911. And the one girl, her cousin, called her dad, which had an extra key to the car, and he was on his way. The other girl went in to the gas station with the attendant, and they called 911. They didn't call the police. They called 911 for medical emergency help. The police came out, responded to the medical emergency help, told them to get away from the car, and just minutes after that, they started shooting. Minutes after they shot her, the cousin's dad came with the key to the car. They said that the eyewitnesses on the scene said that she never moved, that she was the seat was in a totally reclined position, both seats, and they said they never seen her move, respond at all to them knocking on the door. They were shouting, and she never responded. They apparently broke the window out, and I don't know by breaking the window out if that startled them or what. I don't know if they made a condition to get a reaction, or if they just made it the condition to cover up their action, and that is our concern. We feel it was unjustifiable on any count. How can you justify shooting at someone some 40 times that is unconscious or asleep? We are outraged as a family. The community is outraged. I believe America is outraged. Riverside has a shameful history of covering up police shooting and police-involved violence. They do not prosecute the police here. There has been 7 shootings this year. None of them went prosecuted. We are tired. We are sick and tired. The black community is tired. The white community is tired. The Hispanic community is tired. This goes on too much here in Riverside. Riverside is known for their 3-strike law. They give more people 3 strikes here than any other county. The black employees have a class action suit against Riverside. Riverside had just I think it was 2 years ago, eliminated a lot of black jobs, and they just laid these people off that had 20 years, 15 years, and they didn't do that to the white employees. So something is wrong here in Riverside. We're asking for a federal prosecutor. We got one yesterday. We thank God for that. And now we want them to do their job. We want them to go to work and investigate Riverside. We investigate the shooting first. Yes?
Reverend Bernal Butler, can you tell us about these reports the police say that Taisha had a gun on her lap?
Well, I don't really know. The one attendant said he never seen a gun, and the guy that came and helped them said that he never seen a gun. The first time we heard about the gun is when the cousins came with the AAA card, and the cousin, the friend that called 911 stated that she seen a gun. So the gun's pretty much a mystery. I know Taisha, and I had never known her to have a gun. She didn't own a gun, so I don't know this gun.
Now, when the police first met with the family right after the shooting, they said originally that she had fired on the police. Is that right?
Yes, she did. But, you know, because
they said that.
I believe that because the family was right there after the shooting and there was another reporter right on the scene because he heard it on his scanner, that I don't believe they were able to do what they wanted to do at the crime scene. So they couldn't back up their story of her firing a gun. Mm-hmm. So, because when
So they switched from saying that she had fired a gun to that she had a gun and that she had pointed at them.
Well, they went from she fired a gun to she waved the gun, and then it was she was reaching for the gun. And it was just horrible just to listen to that.
Can you tell us a little about your cousin, Taisha Miller? She's 19 years old.
She's 19 years old. She's a real athletic girl. We call her tomboy. She played with the church softball team. She was one of the best first bases and the shortstops that we had. She could probably outplay a lot of the boys in basketball. She was energetic. She loved to go shopping. She had a lot of friends. Everybody loved Taisha. She loved to travel. We went to the beach on many occasions with the church. She helped out with her grandmother with the foster homes, and her aunt had a foster home, and she helped them with the girls. She helped supervise the girls, and she helped do many things around the community. We're shocked about this killing, and we miss her dearly here. Most of the community have came out because this is, to me, as we say, Ray Charles can see the blatant and the indignation that was done to us and to our community. And we feel that if it was a white female teenager, that she would have been treated differently. And, you know, you see these people on TV waving guns, robbing stores. This little girl had car trouble. She didn't rob a store. She wasn't doing a crime. She was waiting for help. And her cousins, naive may they might have been, but they thought they were doing the right thing by calling 911 to get some help and thinking that they are doing the right thing to help their cousin. And I don't know, one person said that it was rescue by murder, and the actual paramedics, the medical emergency specialist, never got a chance to examine Taisha. Even after the police shot her, they waved them on, and she didn't get a professional medical personnel until the coroners came. She was shot at 2 in the morning. The coroner got there at 10 in the morning. So you're looking at, 8 hours almost.
I understand now that Johnny Cochran has got involved with the case, and he's bringing in a doctor to perform a second autopsy who was big in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Well, yes. Yes, he has not just got on board, but he... The second day after the shooting, the family contacted Mr. Cochran and expressed our concerns that this would be a cover-up. And Mr. Cochran is a family man, and he was outraged, and he said that he would help us. And he took the case that day. He assured me he was on vacation in Jamaica. He assured me that he would help, and he has done so. And we thank God for that. He's working with a local lawyer here that knows the ins and outs of Riverside. And this guy, the more I hear about Riverside, the horrible it gets.
Well, Don Pardo, you have been working with Reverend Burnell Butler and the community now dealing with this issue as president and CEO of the Urban League of Riverside. You met with the police chief and mayor yesterday. What did they say?
Exactly like Burnell said, that the Urban League is outraged in this shooting. The number of shots was way too far. Not only in Riverside do we have problems. We have problems in Colton. We have problems in Fontana. We have problems in the surrounding communities of Riverside. The police department here has had an ungodly history of police abuse. However, we think that the new chief has shed a little light on the situation, but again, the new chief is not on the streets. We are happy that the FBI has come in. The march yesterday brought some national attention to the situation, and I think that's why we have the FBI investigation now. The Urban League supports the family. We are dedicated to do whatever we can do necessary to bring these policemen to justice.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I also would like to get a phone number from you, since I hear in what Reverend Burnell Butler is saying is a lot of organizing going on that goes beyond Taisha Miller's case. I'd like to find out about the community and what you've been saying about the number of killings that have gone on there, police shootings in the last year. Also the place where Martin Luther King was supposed to be the namesake for a school, and the white community there fought that, and in the end, it was not named the Martin Luther King School. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute with Don Bardo of the Urban League and Reverend Burnell Butler, cousin of Taisha Miller, killed two Mondays ago by the Riverside Police. Stay with us.
So try your best. Avoid the mess. As far as I could see, it's not really necessary. But when you're right, you're right. Whether you are black or white, when you're wrong, you're wrong. No man can be wrong and strong. The people want justice and liberty. Justice. All we want is justice. We should be living in peace, equitableness.
Justice.
Good and righteousness.
Justice.
We don't want no lip service.
Justice.
We should be living in peace. Let true love abide. Live together side by side. And don't bellyache. Learn to pay for your mistakes. All we want is
justice.
A little bit of
justice.
Tired within.
Justice.
We should be living in peace. We want dependable.
Justice.
Incorruptible.
Justice.
Of the highest principle.
Justice.
We should be living in peace. All the excuse, all the lies, can't stifle the children cry. Their sorrows, their pain, for the little boy who died and the little girl who cried. Ethiopia will rise again.
Justice.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Reverend Burnell Butler, cousin of Taisha Miller, Don Bardo, president and CEO of the Urban League of Riverside and San Bernardino Counties. They're with us today because two Mondays ago, early on the Monday morning of December 28th, Taisha Miller pulled into a gas station with a friend, and because they were having car trouble, and we are just beginning to understand the facts as they emerge, but because they had trouble, Taisha Miller was locked in the car waiting for help to come. They saw she was in medical distress. They called 911. The police came. And after that, ultimately, Taisha Miller was killed by the police in a fusillade of bullets, at least 12. It sounds like, Reverend Burnell Butler, you're saying a lot more than 12.
Well, when I got to the scene that morning, I was going to work also with the utility company down here, and I didn't want to go by the scene when I heard about it. The family had called me, but I had to. I know if I was outraged, that I know, and I'm in the church, I know how the members that are not, that does not know God as their Savior, must have felt. So I went there to support them, and when I got there, I counted 24 shells. The one reporter counted 27, but the attorney has told me that there is markers on the scene in the pictures up to 36. So it's possible they shot at her almost 40 times, and this is really unacceptable. This is shocking. It lets you know the mentality of the police officers. A girl that's reclined all the way down in the seat and could be in medical distress. There was a 911 call for her to get some medical attention, a medical emergency, and then to fire at somebody, four shooters, almost 40 times. That's unacceptable. The eyewitnesses said that one or two of the officers changed clips, reloaded. How many times did it take to kill a person? I wouldn't kill an animal like they killed her. They shot her four times in the head. The coroner said it was four times in the chest and four times in the back. They hit her. It was horrible. I went with the family, the pastor, to get her body and to bring it over to the mortuary. I have never seen anyone as mutilated as that girl's body, and that's why We will not rest as a family. We want at least to have those people brought up before a jury of their own peers. Let the jury decide the evidence on these shooters. Because if it was you or I, we would be in jail now. These people are out on paid leave at the holiday times. And they went out on paid leave. They're on paid leave now. That's like giving them a paid vacation for murdering a black teenage girl. Hmm. And that's unacceptable to us. We will not rest until they are brought to justice, just like you and I would be brought to justice.
Don Bardo, let me just follow up on that question about what's happened to the police. The composition of the community, around 59% white, around 10% black, around 29% Latino. What about the racial attitudes there in Riverside and, for example, the naming of the school, the Martin Luther King School?
Well, the Urban League was instrumental in getting a group of people to go down to fight that naming of the school building. But let me say that the Urban League has received numerous calls, as Burnell had indicated before, of discrimination on the job, police brutality, and other things prior to this happening. And again, not only in Riverside, but the surrounding communities, because we are in the two counties. So that we knew that there was a problem of racial discrimination and police brutality in Riverside. And we were putting together forums and trying to get the Black Attorneys Association to come together to help us do something about this. And then this terrible incident occurred. So we were aware that there are problems here in Riverside, and we knew that because of the number of calls and the way that things were happening, that there was going to be a problem soon. And it's a terrible tragedy that this had to occur, but the Urban League was quite aware that there was a racial problem. A few years ago, last year, as a matter of fact, the city laid off a whole lot of employees without even following proper procedures, and that enraged a lot of people. We have some problems here in the Inland Empire.
We're going to have to wrap up in a minute, though we'll certainly continue to follow the case of Taisha Miller. Reverend Burnell Butler, as you organize, what is a phone number that people can call if they also want to get involved?
Okay, you can call my number at 909-274-9860, or you can contact the Urban League there with Don Bardo, and he is also working with the family here on help organizing rallies and protests, and we're doing a lot. Mr. Jackson has committed himself,
Jesse Jackson,
and the organization CORE had committed themselves, so I believe Don Bardo has a march coming up for the Martin Luther King Day celebration. So we're going to be there to support him and the Urban League, and they're supporting our efforts here to get justice here in Riverside.
Right, and Burnell, you may want to filter those calls to us because we do have a staff to handle that, and I think you're going to be overwhelmed if you put your number up.
I think so, too. If you could just give Don Bardo
the number
out
of
also.
The Urban League.
Right.
What is the number, Don Bardo?
That number is area code 909-682-2766.
That's 909-682-2766.
And the fax number, for people who've had problems in the Inland Empire, we're trying to compile some scenarios of people who have police brutality in the past and have not reported it or have reported it so that we can have some statistics. Please fax those in to us at area code 909-682-2318.
That's 909-682-2318. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Don Bardo, President and CEO of the Urban League of Riverside and San Bernardino Counties, and Reverend Burnell Butler, cousin of Taisha Miller, who was killed two Mondays ago in a hail of bullets from the Riverside Police Department in Riverside, California. We will continue to follow the story. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After a short music break, we go to the Niger Delta to find out about the bloodbath there, what took place over the weekend, and why are so many Ijaw youth being killed? Stay with us.
We should be living in peace. Let true love abide. Live together side by side. And don't bellyache.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go now to the Niger Delta. You know, having returned from Nigeria just a few months ago, I don't think I've seen more inaccurate reporting than I have in trying to understand as we've come back from Nigeria, what's happening there today. And that particularly relates to what has happened there over the weekend. And so we go directly to the Niger Delta to find out how it is that scores of young people in the Niger Delta, in the oil-rich region, one of the most oil-rich regions of all of Africa that provides so much oil to the rest of the world, why it is the military under General Abubakar has opened fire on Ijaw youth. We go now to Port Harcourt in Nigeria to Oronto Douglas, who is an environmental activist and lawyer and is with Environmental Rights Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Oronto Douglas.
Yeah, thank you very much, Amy.
It's very good to have you back with us. We spoke with you when you were in the United States. Can you tell us what has been happening there?
On the 11th of December 1998, 5,000 Ijaw youth met in the historic town of Kayama, and where a decision was taken called the Kayama Declaration. In that decision, we decided that all the transnational oil companies that are operating in the Delta, polluting our land, and authorizing the military to invade communities and so on, should cease oil production and come and negotiate with the people of Ijoland and all other ethnic nationalities in the Niger Delta. And the declaration was made hoping that there will be dialogue, but what followed was a vicious crackdown on the ordinary people of Ijoland.
We should let our listeners know that Ijaw is an ethnic group in Nigeria, the fourth largest ethnic group, highly concentrated in the south, in the oil-rich region. You yourself are Ijaw, aren't you, Oronto Douglas?
Yes, I am Ijaw. And over the past 42 years, when our fathers told us that the oil companies came to Oloibiri for the first time, a community in Ijawland, they have continued a very vicious ecological campaign which has endangered our survival strategies. And all we have asked for is that we should be allowed to survive as a people, that we do not want to be killed because oil had to be taken out to the people of America. And we have asked that in their taking out the oil, it should be done in an ecologically responsible manner. This they have ignored, and when Ken Saro-Wiwa of the Ogoni people protested, he was viciously hanged, and over 2,000 Ogoni people were killed. And all these protests had been most peaceful. And we felt that we too should also carry out peaceful, non-violent campaign by initiating what we call Operation Climate Change, which should then allow oil companies to withdraw and negotiate with us. The result is the killing of several youths in the Niger Delta area of Ijawland over the past couple of days.
How many people would you estimate have been killed, Oronto Douglas?
Independent analysis from the Niger Delta Human and Environmental Rescue Organization had put the total figure running into almost 200 youths. And this is rather unfortunate because the Kayama Declaration is not a declaration of war. It is a declaration of dialogue. We are saying that pumping, what the oil companies are doing is pumping barrels of blood out of our land at this moment, and we are calling on them to cease forthwith their operation in the Ijaw area so that we can negotiate on the issues of our survival.
Now, the report we've gotten from Associated Press is that there was a temporary peace agreement worked out over the weekend between protesting youths and troops protecting oil installations in Bayelsa State, one of the states in southern Nigeria. Is this true?
There is no such truce. There is no such meeting that has taken place. I think Associated Press is being misled because there is the Ijaw Coordinating Council, which takes decision on this matter. I think they are misquoting the youths who are appealing to the government to withdraw their troops in the area, because as I am talking to you now, women are being raped, People are being shot. People go into, soldiers identify you if you are Ijo. They pick you out of vehicles and have you shot. And this violence on people, defenseless youths, is continuing even to this minute.
How do they identify whether a person is Ijo?
Well, by the tongue, the way you speak, because as you know, the Ijos have this tongue, this way of pronouncing certain words. You know, and they can do that through the way you pronounce words and also by the tribal marks you have on your face. Or if they ask you which community you are from, and if you say you are any community from Bayelsa State, then you are subject of attack.
What does this say about what many have hailed as a new day in Nigeria under General Abubakar, that he is bringing in democracy, that there will be elections, there will be civilian rule?
We should not be deceived by the promise of democracy by General Abubakar. The military are not capable of giving us democracy. As you very well know, the command structure of the military will not give battle the emergence of a people-oriented democracy. All we ask for is a sovereign national conference of the various ethnic nationalities so that we can sit down together to discuss our problems. The Ijos, the Isokos, the Urobos, the Ishakiris and the Ligers and all other ethnic nationalities can live together with all other peoples of Nigeria. We are capable of living together, but we have to discuss via dialogue. There is nothing as sweet as dialogue, not even honey. We are saying that we must encourage that dialogue option, and we must ask the military to withdraw their tanks, their bombs, their warships, their bullets and their guns, which they are raining on the towns of Kayama, Patani, and Yenagoa.
What has happened to the oil installations that are there in the area, and which companies run them?
Well, as you know, the Operation Climate Change started on the 1st of January, and Operation Climate Change is aimed and directed at extinguishing the ferocious and very vicious gas flares that banish our night, that prevents our crops from growing well, that encourages the pollution of our waters and our streams. So as a result of the declaration of climate change, a lot of the oil facilities have been closed down. Those closed down include the Beni Seide flow station, the Opukushi, the Tumama, the Etelebu, several other companies belonging to Shell. And then, of course, there's the Clockery belonging to Agip. And then, of course, there are some that belong to Chevron. And this operation is continuing, and it is expected to end on the 10th, when we believe that the oil companies should sit down with us to discuss the best way forward, and not through violence, not through guns, not through the brutalization or raping of our people.
How have the Ijo youth shut down these operations? What do they actually do?
Well, it's very easy. Shutting down a flow station means turning off the valve. We are environmentalists, and as leaders of the Coordinating Council, we do not want a situation about what we are complaining against, which is environmental degradation, to be continued in a situation of shutting down. A lot of the people that are helping to shut down are people that are ordinarily aware of the technicalities of oil production and who are very sympathetic to the cause of the Ijo people.
We're talking to Oronto Douglas in Port Harcourt in southern Nigeria. He is a leader of the Ijo youth movement. He is with Environmental Rights Action and a Pan-Delta resistance group called Chikoko, named for the soil of the region. This in Nigeria, the world's sixth largest oil-producing nation. Right now, are there any organized protests allowed in Nigeria?
No. Yesterday, the military governor of Bayelsa State claimed to have lifted the curfew and the state of emergency. But he went on to say that all processions, all meetings, all forms of associations are banned. People are not expected to meet to discuss on any issue concerning their survival strategies or to discuss anything whatsoever concerning with the state of emergency that was just lifted, or the protest of the youths. So the situation is such that there are so many soldiers in Yenagoa, so many soldiers in Kayama, so many soldiers in Patani, and indeed the two towns of Kayama and Patani remain sacked since the past 3 days, and the inhabitants have fled into the bush and they are living in the forest, and they are dying of hunger. There is a food blockade of communities in the Niger Delta today. As you very well know, a lot of the food comes from the upland area, and the military are deliberately put a blockade so that food cannot go into the deep delta. And we are suffering from hunger right now. There may be fear of a massive epidemic occurring in the whole area, and we are calling on the international community to prevail on the military dictatorship to withdraw their troops. The declaration, the Kayama Declaration, is not a declaration of war. It is a declaration of dialogue. It is an invitation on the transnational oil companies to enter into dialogue with us concerning their environmentally degrading activities, and also the military dictatorship not to impose a fraudulent transition program on us, and that they should get out of office, and that we want a sovereign national conference to discuss the differences of opinion within the various strands of ethnic nationalities that exist, so that we can fashion a country that the future generation of Nigerians and all of humanity will be able to benefit.
Aronto Douglas, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I'd like to ask you how you're protecting yourself, a marked man in Nigeria. And we'll also be joined by Bronwyn Mambi, who is a researcher for Human Rights Watch in London, who is just preparing a large report on the oil-producing region of Nigeria on the Delta, and who's gotten some interesting words back from one major oil producer in Nigeria, and that's Chevron. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We've been speaking with Aronto Douglas. We'll come back to him, a leader of the Ijaw movement. The soldiers in Nigeria have opened fire on young people there, deaths ranging from 50 to 100, perhaps more, over the weekend, although a state of emergency, as you heard Aronto Douglas say, has been lifted, at least according to the government. The soldiers remain en masse in the southern region. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I've been thinking about how to talk about tea. I've been thinking about how to talk about tea. I've been wondering if I could sing about tree. Trying to find a way to talk about tree. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops its work, it never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been thinking about how.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, rejoined by Aronto Douglas, who is near where, in fact, Ken Sarawiwa was incarcerated, the Ogoni leader who fought against Shell for the Ogoni people. And he was incarcerated there in the Niger Delta, near where we're talking to Aronto Douglas, and ultimately executed there. Aronto Douglas with us here because over the weekend, this large number of people, we understand scores of Ijaw young people, have been killed by the Nigerian military. Also, we are joined by Bronwyn Mambi of Human Rights Watch in London. Aronto, how are you protecting yourself right now?
Well, the only protection I have is the Almighty God and myself. God, because he's our creator. Myself, because I have to take extra care to ensure that wherever I go, wherever I meet, does not form a source of danger to me. And God, because it is only God that can really protect anyone that is on this planet.
Bronwyn Mambi, you are producing for Human Rights Watch a report on the Delta. You have investigated the oil companies extensively. You have recently got word from Chevron about some communication. Can you describe what's happened?
Maybe I should backtrack a bit first. Your listeners will know the Pacifica Radio Democracy Now! Feature about the incident on the Chevron Parabe platform in Nigeria from May 1998, in which two youths were shot by soldiers who were flown to the platform by helicopters hired by Chevron. When that incident happened and was informed about it by colleagues in Nigeria, including Oronto Douglas, immediately wrote to Chevron and asked them for their comments on this incident and raised concerns about that we had about their involvement in the deaths of these two youths. And initially got a long response back from them with information and their side of the story. I sent them a couple of subsequent letters, which initially they did not respond to. On sending a follow-up, I got a letter, which is somewhat ironically in the current situation, dated December the 11th, at the date of the Kayama Declaration, of which the final paragraph reads as follows. We believe we have fully explained the circumstances surrounding this incident, and we do not intend to engage in further correspondence with Human Rights Watch on this issue. Be assured, however, that Chevron is committed to maintaining its positive long-term relationships with our local communities and will continue our dialogue with the leaders and the people of those communities. What I find unfortunate about this letter is that if Human Rights Watch, which has a high profile in the U.S., where Chevron's headquarters is, can't persuade the company to dialogue with us, we're asking questions of serious concern, then I think it is certainly raises questions as to how they respond to local groups in Nigeria who are, in this context, far more important than Human Rights Watch.
Hmm. Oronto Douglas, as you listen to that letter and Chevron saying, while we won't speak to Human Rights Watch, we will continue to work with local communities and leaders, in Nigeria is what they're referring to. What is your response?
I think it clearly shows the contemptuous disregard of even mediators and impartial observers like Human Rights Watch on this matter. For us, we have no voice. We have no power to compel mighty multinationals like Chevron to do anything. What they say on the pages of newspaper, what their PR men and scenario planners and spin doctors say is different from what is happening on the ground. As you very well know, the same Chevron is one company that has caused the greatest man-made ecological devastation in the Niger Delta. I am talking of the devastation that is still presently visible in the Niger area, where several kilometers of tropical rainforest was devastated by Chevron.
So what are you calling on people in the United States now to do in response to the current emergency, the crisis that has emerged over the last few weeks, and in general, when we have a number of U.S. Chartered, U.S. transnational corporations like Chevron, like Mobil, that are operating in Nigeria, and also the large multinational corporation Shell?
Well, we know that the people of the United States need oil. We know that it is cold in certain parts and they need this oil to keep warm. We know that they need this oil also to fire their engines and be able to carry out industrial production and so on. But what we are appealing to the people of the United States is to understand that what they are pumping out of our land are barrels of blood, not barrels of crude oil at this moment. And we are appealing to the ordinary people of the United States and those policymakers and all those who are capable of telling Chevron and Mobil and Exxon and all these companies from there, like Texaco as well, that they should please ask them to withdraw from our land, to get into negotiation with us, because their presence was based on fraudulent military decrees which took away our land, took away our rights to existence as a people, and we say we want to live together with all other ethnic nations and all other peoples of the world. We want to be able to see the children of America and say, hello, good morning, American children. We are from Nigeria. We should fight together for the benefit of humanity. That we cannot do if this transnational corporation continues to destroy our environment, which belongs not just to our present, but to the future generation of children from Nigeria.
There are a number of groups working on this issue in the United States, the Africa Fund, Human Rights Watch, Project Underground, Institute for Policy Studies. Project Underground sent us a statement saying that, in fact, what's happening right now in the south of Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, where we're speaking to you right now, Oronto Douglas, truly a miracle. Sometimes technology really works in our favor. that there is a kind of task force that has been set up similar to the River State Internal Task Force, which is what Ken Sarawiwa and the Ogoni people fought so hard and which were so brutal against the Ogoni people. What is this task force that's been set up currently?
Yes, it is called Operation Salvage. And the main difference between Operation Salvage and the Internal Security Task Force in Ogoni is that Operation Salvage has the military capacity to declare a state of emergency. It has the military capacity to invade and sack communities. It has the capacity without question, and it takes its directive directly from General Abubakar Abdusalam, to put down in the most vicious and violent of manner anyone who threatens the economic interests of Nigeria. And you read economic interest to mean oil interest, because the Nigerian economy is sold and hooked to oil. And so we are at the receiving end of this invasion of our humanity.
Bronwyn Mambi, you're going to be coming out with a report on the oil corporations and what they do in Nigeria. Can you give us a preview of your findings?
Yes, the research on the report is clearly being upstaged by current events in Nigeria, but it's based on spending a month in the Delta, looking at a number, and at that stage of much less serious incidents than currently taking place, but incidents where people have been detained, where people had been shot, in some cases killed, and where people had been, and in many cases where people had been beaten up. Often, sometimes where large numbers of people have made a demonstration, but often where individual families or single people had been to an oil facility and said made requests for compensation for environmental damage or looking for work. And in repeated cases, those people had been beaten by Nigerian security forces. What you're also looking at is what is the role and responsibilities of the oil companies in this situation. Their argument is that they are working in joint ventures with the Nigerian government, and it's the Nigerian government's decision to send the security who defend their installations. We say that is clearly they have an interest in security for their installations, and we would not deny that. However, if security should be provided, then they should take all steps to ensure that security is provided in a way that does not result in beatings, torture, arbitrary detentions, and above all, killings. And I think that it's quite clear that none of the oil companies in Nigeria are taking all those steps. I think it's significant, for example, that over this incident over the last few days in the community of Kayama in particular, I'm not aware that any of the oil companies have made statements calling for restraint, for example, or calling for the security forces to be withdrawn from this community. And it's not clear all the details that have happened there yet, but it's very clear that tens of people and possibly more than 200 people have been killed. And I think that it's incumbent upon the oil companies, about whom this protest is, to say, look, we do not want the military to act in this way on our behalf.
Aronto Douglas, do you have any sense right now of the level of cooperation between the oil companies and the current onslaught from the soldiers in Nigeria?
One thing I can say very authoritatively is that all the soldiers that have flown from their various garrisons in Port Harcourt to Brass, we are flown by oil companies. And we can also say that the oil companies have refused to condemn the activities of the soldiers, their excesses in Bayelsa State. They have told us that they will not work under military shield, yet as at this moment, those flow stations that have not been closed are being guarded by soldiers. And the soldiers work in concert with their business partners, the transnational oil companies. And the situation where our youth now beg them in the communities that they should leave the flow station because Operation Climate Change must be carried out to its logical conclusion non-violently, we fear that they may unleash bullets on these defenseless youths, and that may cause further bloodbath in the society. And we are calling on them, using this opportunity, to tell Texaco, Chevron, Mobil, Shell, and all the oil companies that exist here that they should peacefully withdraw their operations and enter into dialogue with the youths of Ijoland, with the youths of Isokoland, who have also shut all their facilities in the whole of Isoko Kingdom.
So again, as we wrap up this discussion, Aronto Douglas, what you're calling for right now, both of the Nigerian military regime to stop the killing at this point, and also of the American people who are listening right now to you in the Niger Delta in Nigeria.
So give us, the American people should give us a hand of solidarity in this moment of our struggle. Our struggle is not just for Nigeria, it's a struggle for humanity. The climate is being destroyed by the activities of transnational companies. We are saying that a consistent and persistent pollution of the environment could lead to environmental refugees, because if people do not survive from their traditional sources of livelihood, that is fishing and farming, and there are no industries that would absorb the attendant unemployment that will follow from the destruction of the very base of survival, that not only Nigeria will suffer, but the entire humanity, because the dehumanization of humanity will follow at this instance, and we do not want people to pity us. Let us take preventive steps to prevent this destruction of our collective goal as a people.
Well, Aronto Douglas, I want to thank you very much for joining us from the Niger Delta. It is truly remarkable that we were able to hear you so clearly and actually able to get in touch with you today. I tried all day yesterday, and we hope that you remain safe. If people want to get in touch with Environmental Rights Action, with the Ijaw Youth Movement, where can they call? Or where can they or go on the web?
Yes, with the Environmental Rights Action, we have a number in Benin, and also email address.
Mm-hmm.
The number in Benin is 052-600-165, and the email is eraction, eraction, at infoweb.abs.net. And also in Port Harcourt, we have 084-236365. Again, 084-236365. 65, and the email is oilwash, OILWATCH, at infoweb.abs.net.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And those two email addresses, eraction, eraction, at infoweb.abs.net, or oilwatch at infoweb.abs.net. And if people want to go to the web to get the reports on Nigeria, Bronwyn Mambi, as well as the future report when it comes out, where can they go?
The Human Rights Watch report will be posted on the Human Rights Watch website address, which is www.hrw.org. And there are, in fact, many other sites where information on Nigeria can be found, of which probably the most comprehensive is www.nigeria.com.
That's www.nigeria.com. Thank you both, Bronwyn Mambi from Human Rights Watch in London and Aronto Douglas joining us from Port Harcourt in Nigeria as this latest onslaught continues from the Nigerian military. And I want to let you know that tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be taking a look at mobile. What did mobile know? We'll look at mobile in Indonesia. And a Business Week report that's just come out that documents human rights organizations issuing a statement asserting mobile is responsible for human rights abuses during major Indonesian military operations in Aceh, where killings are going on as we speak. That does it for today's program. If you'd like a copy of today's show or our Nigeria documentary, Drilling and Killing, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks to Errol Maitland, Robert Knight, Norman Kelly, and others, as well as Joe Gill, for joining us and helping out today. Thanks for listening.